Explore the tropics at Whole Foods Market through April 16th. Save on juicy finds like yellow mangoes at 5 for $5 with Prime. Sweet Dacopan citrus is back, just $3.49 per pound with Prime. Plus, save on seasonal favorites like dragon fruit, kiwi, pineapple, and more. In the meat department, pick up animal welfare certified meats with tropical-inspired marinades. And be sure to try the spicy Hawaiian pizza, back for a limited time. Only at Whole Foods Market.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Welcome, welcome, welcome back to the Bob Left Fifth Podcast. My guest today is truly legendary singer-songwriter Tom Rush. Tom?
Hi, Bob. It's good to see you.
Okay. Now, you had COVID. Tell me about that.
Well, I don't recommend it. It was not fun. It was back in March. I was an early adapter. And I've just felt awful for about 2 weeks. It was 5 days of getting worse, 5 days of feeling like crap, 5 days of getting better. And I never got most of the typical symptoms. I just felt exhausted and achy all over. And I ran a little bit of a fever, but I just slept 20 hours a day at the bottom of the curve. And then I got better. And then a couple of months later, I was having heart palpitations, and the doc told me I should wear a heart monitor for 2 weeks. I did. I mailed it in. He calls me at 5:30 on Friday, because these things never happen Tuesday morning, and says, basically, get your ass to an ambulance and have them bring you to Mass General. And I said, excuse me, what are you talking about? And he said, we're concerned you might have an event. And I said, okay, what kind of event? And he said, well, the technical term is sudden cardiac death. And that got my attention. And in fact, I didn't go straight in. Because that's the kind of guy I am, I went back to where I was living and had a nice dinner with a glass of wine and went in the next morning. And they put a pacemaker in me. They discovered quite accidentally, totally unrelated to any heart palpitations, that my heart rate was going down to 23 beats a minute. And so they put a pacemaker in, and now I am pretty much invincible.
Okay, for those of us out of the know, what exactly is a pacemaker, and do you know you have it in you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a little bump in my chest. I mean, I pretty much have to bow out of all the bathing suit competitions from now on. They weren't going well anyway, but no, it basically, this pacemaker, they do different things. This one, if my heart rate goes below 50 beats a minute, it will kick in and keep my heart rate above 50 beats a minute.
And when it does kick in, are you aware of that?
No.
Okay, no. So other than the bump, it's totally, you know, transparent. You don't know what's going on.
No, it doesn't bother me a bit.
Okay, what do they think caused it?
They don't know, but I think COVID caused it. I really do. When I was in the cardiac ward at Mass General, which is locally referred to as, it's in Massachusetts General Hospital, locally it's referred to as Massive Genitals. But when I was in the cardiac ward there, the nurse observed that they had a lot of COVID survivors. And this is at a point when way less than 1% of the population were COVID survivors. So it made me think that maybe COVID causes heart problems.
And how do you think you got it, COVID?
I think I got it on a plane. I was doing gigs in Florida, and I had a week off and then more gigs in Florida. And I came back to Boston for my week off and started feeling crummy on day four of the week off. Meanwhile, all the other gigs were canceled. And fortunately, my daughter was staying with me, and she took care of me. And then she got the same bug. She actually tested negative, but she had to have had it. She had the same symptoms. And
now, I know you frequently work with Matt Nakoa. Was he on that gig with you?
He was. He didn't get it. There were several people that I was hanging out with that didn't get it. So I think I got it on the plane coming north.
And then, have you gotten the vaccine?
I've just, I'm 3 days away from being totally invincible. I've had my second shot almost 2 weeks ago.
Okay. Now, if one goes to your webpage, it appears that you've been doing live gigs during this interim. Tell us the story there.
Well, actually, I think the website may have been misleading. I'm about to do this coming Saturday, the 20th of March. I'm about to do a show at the Birchmere in Alexandria, Virginia, which will be my first live gig this year. The website, I think, should be telling you that this, that, and the other gig have been rescheduled until
I guess what I was saying, meaning I follow you pretty closely, but it seemed like you were putting it out there that you would play private, socially distanced gigs.
I was doing that. I'm trying to figure out ways to survive this. And the public gigs were being canceled. And I figured, well, it's, you know, the weather's nice. This was in the fall. I'm in the Northeast. And so I put out this thing that said, hey, let's do some private shows outdoors, properly distanced outdoor private shows with small gatherings. And it worked. I did, you know, five or six of them, and it paid the rent. And then winter set in, so that's over. I'm hoping to kick it back into action in a month or so when the weather cheers up here.
Interestingly, you also put your price on the website. You said you normally get paid $10,000. Is it a factor of age and you just don't care anymore? Because certainly this is a business where you could do the same gig and the price could vary widely. So people are really loath to quote a price.
Well, it's, you know, and the price does vary widely. It depends, you know, if I have to fly to Australia to do it, it's going to cost more than if it's just down the block. I was giving about a 50% discount on private shows, and people signed up for them. So great. But then that was shut down because of the weather. And then I started this Rockport Sundays series on Patreon.
Before we get into the Patreon thing, you know, to what degree do you have to work to make your nut? And we talk about different musicians are in different levels. And also there are a lot of very household name musicians who have high overheads. So when this shut down, were you starting to freak out, or this was just impacting your lifestyle? Or you said, God, I got to keep myself busy.
Well, it was a little of each. I mean, the cash flow, the 2020 was shaping up to be the best year ever from a, you know, business standpoint. And then just mid-March just stopped.
Okay, well, let's stop there for a second. Why was 20, so deep into your career, 60 years into your career, why was 2020 shaping up to be the best?
I can't answer that. More, you know, I was getting more bookings for, you know, for bigger crowds. I think I've gotten better over the years, Bob.
Okay, yeah, you know, unless that's one thing people don't realize about getting older. You know, all this focus on youth, we do get wiser. In many cases, we do get better. But you were answering the question about the cash.
Oh, well, the cash flow just went off the cliff. Now, I don't have a lot of overhead because I don't have a band these days. As you say, I work with Matt Nakoa, and he gets paid when I get paid. And Matt is actually, to go back to the Rockport Sundays, he's been participating on a lot of those little episodes. But I don't have didn't have a lot of overhead, but I do have, you know, I've got to pay the rent, and now I've got to pay my wife's rent. She's off in Wyoming now. And, you know, health insurance, and I've got a kid in college and stuff like that. So I was invading savings and decided I'd invaded savings about enough, and I should try to figure out how to make some money. And I also, I love playing for people. And I was suffering audience deprivation syndrome.
And so tell us about the Patreon.
Well, I checked out a bunch of different platforms. I was living in Rockport, Massachusetts, and I wrote this instrumental years ago called Rockport Sunday that people seemed to like a lot. And I thought, okay, well, maybe I'll do this. I'll put out a video clip of one song or a story, perhaps, every Sunday. And it'll be a subscription series, and it costs $10 a month at the bottom level. And you get a song, a video clip of me in the kitchen, very casual. The production values are good because I've got a guy who's very professional doing the audio and video, but I'm very casual. I haven't done one in my pajamas yet, but you never know. And I'll sing a song for you, tell you a story about the song, sing a song, and that's it. And that song will then be available for 8 weeks. And it will then disappear to make room for whatever the newest thing is. And some weeks I tell a story. I told the story of Clint Eastwood and the hashish brownie. And I'll tell the story about skinny dipping with Janis Joplin some episode.
You know, just as a teaser for those who might sign up, tell us the story of skinny dipping with Janis Joplin.
No, Bob, you have to subscribe.
Well, okay, if someone subscribed, is it already off the 8 weeks, or could they still get it?
No, well, I haven't done the Janis Joplin one yet, but that was okay. I'll give you a taste of that. I was on the Festival Express tour across Canada, and it was quite an adventure. It was a bunch of musicians on a train: the Grateful Dead, Janis Joplin, the band, Delaney and Bonnie, Ian and Sylvia. On and on. And we started in Toronto, ended in Calgary. And when we got to Calgary, this was the best party I have ever been to. We kind of regarded the stadium shows that we had to stop and do as unwelcome intrusions into the flow of the party. We got to Calgary and the promoters had hired the municipal swimming pool so that we could all go for a swim, which was very sweet and much appreciated. And of course, all of these hippie musicians wanted to go skinny dipping, which horrified the pool officials, but it was our pool, you know, they couldn't stop us. But they did have a rule, hard and fast rule, that anyone with long hair, which was everybody, had to wear a bathing cap. And my mind is permanently scarred by the sight of seeing Leslie West of Mountain coming out of the changing room wearing nothing but a bathing cap over his afro and a second bathing cap upside down over his beard. You can't unsee something like that.
And now on that Festival Express, certainly Janis Joplin was a famous drinker with Southern Comfort. During that day, and maybe even today, to what degree did you partake in substances?
Well, there were a lot of substances on that train. Alcohol was very popular. We, in fact, drank the train dry about 4 hours out of Toronto, which was the first. And we made them stop in a little prairie town, went into the liquor store and bought everything. Every bottle in that store went back on the train. And we continued on, and it was a very strange experience, I'm sure, for the staff on the train. These were guys with jackets and little red bow ties who are used to dealing with families on vacation. And all of a sudden, they've got a train full of hippies, you know, smoking dope and doing God knows what. But it was very cool. I remember seeing Janis Joplin. I was talking with Delaney, or Bonnie Bramlett of Delaney and Bonnie. I was chatting with her. Janis comes running in and says, Bonnie, you've got to come. I'm doing an interview with Time Magazine, and I just realized that you and I are the same person. You've got to come and participate in this interview with me. And so she gets up, and I trailed along because I wanted to find out how it was that Janis and Bonnie were the same person. And Bonnie was talking about how talent was a gift from God, but it was also a curse in a way, because God had given you this gift, you were obliged to go out and share it with people. And it means leaving your family and leading a very difficult life out on the road. But this is what God demands of you. Janis, on the other hand, was talking about how great it was to be a rock star because you get laid a lot. Somehow they were the same person in Janis's mind.
Just going back, though, when you were on the road, to what degree or in your career did you partake of drugs, whether it be marijuana, cocaine, heroin, or anything?
I did a bunch of stuff. Pot, of course, was kind of de rigueur. I did too much cocaine for a while, and I actually stopped cocaine because I got a hold of some pharmaceutical coke, and it was so good that I was so pissed that I'd been spending all this money on garbage, been snorting mothballs. I just stopped. I never got involved in the harder stuff because when I was a little kid, I was sickly and I got a lot of injections and I developed a real aversion to needles. So anything that involved a needle, no thank you, get that thing away from me, which served me well.
Okay, also you had a very big birthday about a month ago. How does that affect you emotionally?
Well, not much. I mean, I'm feeling good. I think, you know, I'm writing more than I ever wrote. I'm having a lot of fun with Rockport Sundays and very much looking forward to getting back on the road. So the only part of it was there was a big birthday bash scheduled for the Wang Center in Boston, which is this absolutely drop-dead gorgeous 3,500-seat hall. And we were going to get all kinds of guest artists. And Garth Brooks, in fact, you know, put together a happy birthday video clip for the occasion. And it had to be canceled. So basically, Bob, I have suspended aging. And as soon as we can do it, we'll have my 80th birthday party at the Wang Center.
Okay. So what's your relationship with Garth Brooks?
He has credited me many times over the years as being one of the first people. His dad, I guess, played some of my albums for the kids when he was little, and he came to like my music a lot. So that's really the only connection. I've never met the guy.
Okay, so you talk about being very creative in writing at this particular point in time. But on some level, which is interesting from an outside observer, the landscape is identical to when you started. When you started first, you know, there was 50s rock, Frank Sinatra, then the teen idols. And now we have teen idols again and everything spread out. So what do you think about this change in landscape and what motivates you today?
I guess what motivates me is again, I love to play for people. I love to get up on stage and make people laugh and cry and, you know, dig into their emotional their emotional life. I get a lot of pleasure out of that. The landscape is, because of the internet, is totally different. You know, when I started out, if you didn't have a record deal, you did not exist because it was the record companies who got you on the radio and got you written up in the magazines, and that sold tickets. And but without that, you were invisible. Now, any kid with a laptop can, you know, make music in their bedroom and put it up on the internet. And some of it's terrible, some of it's wonderful, but you don't need the record company anymore. And it's become very confusing. I mean, the whole genre question has become very muddy. It used to be, you know, there was jazz, there was classical, there was folk, there were blues and rock. And that was about it. And I remember actually my first album came out on a little private label in Cambridge. And I went into the Harvard Coop, the local record store, and they'd put my album under blues in the blues section. And I went to the manager. I said, well, excuse me, I do some blues. Yes, but I also do traditional folk material. And he said, okay. And he took my albums and put them in the folk section. I said, well, wait a second. Yes, I do some folk, but I also, and he finally, after a couple of more of these, he said, okay, kid. And he put me in miscellaneous. And I learned my lesson not to argue about categories, but now there's so many categories. I mean, I want to actually, I'm thrilled, Bob, to be able to announce that last night I won all the Grammys, every single
really?
One of them. Every single one of them. Anybody that says otherwise is false. That's false news.
Were you ever nominated for a Grammy?
To be honest, I can't remember. I don't think so.
Well, since you went there, what is your thought about the Grammy organization and the Grammy winning?
I don't know. I've fallen so far away from the industry that I don't really pay much attention to it. I mean, it's great for the folks who win something, but I'm not sure what it means. It means that a bunch of people with a very skewed point of view voted for them. It doesn't necessarily mean they're good. It just means they're popular with a certain very restricted crowd. So I just don't put a lot of stock in it.
Okay. Now you have varying levels on Patreon. Tell us about that.
Well, I started out with just one, they call them tiers. And the tier that I started out with was the $10 a month tier, where you get every Sunday a brand new song or a story. And then I added a bunch more tiers. For $25 a month, you get, of course, the song or the story, but you also get pages from a book I'm writing. And it goes all the way up to $1,000 a month, where you get a private concert at the end of so many months and, you know, some Zoom chats, a Zoom chat once a month, and some special treatment. This is one of my $1,000 guys wants me to come up with an instructional video teaching him how to play The Dreamer, which is a song I think is one of my better songs, not better known, but anyway, he wants me to, and I will. I'll come up with an instructional video, and he will learn how to play The Dreamer.
Okay, that begs the question of, these people are paying. Does that affect your relationship? And this also blends to, you know, you tour sort of on a circuit. Do you tend to know your fans? Does that good, or is it a burden? What's that like?
I don't know. The you know, I do see some of the same faces at shows. But one of the things I do when I remember is, when I hit the stage, I say, how many of you guys have never been to one of my shows before? And about half the crowd will put their hand up. So it's not the same people coming back every time. The Patreon series of Rockport Sundays, I get a lot of comments. People can write comments, and I respond to as many as I can. And I've noticed that some of the same people comment every week. The song goes up at midnight Eastern time, midnight on Saturday. And Sunday morning, I've got, you know, an inbox full of comments from Patreon. And some of the same people are commenting each time, but the feedback's really positive. It's almost as good as live applause.
Let's just assume we had to cut you off from the feedback. Would you be able to survive?
It would cut out a lot of dopamine. The dopamine rush from the applause or the feedback is part of what's in it for me. I want to hear what you think. I want it, and hopefully you like it. If you don't like it, then I'd like to know that too.
Okay, at this point in time, are you still concerned with growing your audience? You know, how do you deal with that? Because as you say, the game has changed. We don't have the record company push, and there's so much in the channel.
Oh yeah, I'm very focused on growing the audience. I mean, it's actually one of the exciting things about the Rockport Sunday series online. It keeps me up at night that there are 7.5 billion people on the planet that haven't signed up yet. But I know that having, you know, been on Bob Lefsetz's podcast, things will...
Oh, you're going to the moon now.
Oh, yeah. Here we go.
You'll win all the Grammys next year.
Fasten your seatbelts. Absolutely. No, I think the potential for growth is terrific on the internet because there really is no ceiling.
Well, there's a potential, but there's so much there. Do you find in this internet era of last 20 years when everybody's got more questions than answers that your audience is increasing or maybe you can't even tell at all?
Well, the online audience, I also send out a newsletter from my website, tomrush.com, and you can sign up for the newsletter at tomrush.com. And people seem to like that a lot. I get silly. I try to keep it amusing. And people seem to be amused. So I've got, you know, about 15,000 people there. But that could easily, you know, that, you know, I would love to see that grow as well. And as for the, you know, the live audiences, of course, right now it's really restricted. I'm playing the Birchmere this coming Saturday. It's a 500-seat room. They're only selling 200 tickets. And some of the other gigs coming up in May and June are going to be the same kind of thing. Either they've moved outdoors or they're going to have restricted capacity. And hopefully sometime in the fall, this will start to loosen up.
So what's the key to a great show?
I wish I could. Well, of course, me.
Well, I mean, that's a given. You're here. We're talking to you. You have a profile. But, you know, you're there. Do you feel that you have to convince them or you're singing rock? You're singing No Regrets and you're thinking about your next connection at the airport?
No, I'm in the best of worlds. I'm very, very focused on the audience. Part of the fun for me is figuring out who this audience is. I visualize an audience as being a personality. And it's been striking to me. I used to play clubs way back in the day. It'd be a 2-week gig. I'd show up, you know, and play every night for 2 weeks. And it was really amazing how different the audience was from night to night. It was the same town, the same demographic, the same weather, but the audience would be totally different each night. And I would have to figure out who that audience is, what that personality is, and then basically play to that person. Some audiences really like the funny songs, so I'd do more funny songs. And some like the touching introspective stuff, the sensitive shit, as my lead guitar player used to call it.
And so, especially when you had a band, to what degree did you have a set list, or to what degree, depending on the audience, did you change your repertoire and to this day?
Well, I know what song I'm going to start with. I know what song I'm going to end with. And in between, I'm flexible. I do have to, one of the disadvantages to having a band is you have to stick to the songs that the band knows. Whereas solo, I don't have that problem. And with Matt, I can throw a new song at Matt and he'll play it as though he'd been doing it his entire life. He's quite an amazing talent. I should throw in mattnakoa.com into the conversation. He's, we've been playing together for about 6 years, but he's got his own career, which is burgeoning. And I don't think he's going to be backing me up for too much longer. I'm hoping that when he's playing stadiums, he'll let me open the shows.
As we wave goodbye to winter's chill, it's time to give our lawn a little love and embrace the freshness of spring. And guess what? The Home Depot's Spring Black Friday sale is here to make it all a breeze. Snag the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and say goodbye to tedious yard work. With a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power, your lawn will look spotless in a flash. And the best part? Thanks to the convenience of online shopping, you can effortlessly place your order via the app, cruise into the store for pickup, and find yourself chilling in your freshly spruced up yard in no time. Don't let this awesome deal blow away. Get your hands on the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for only $89. Yeah, just $89. Exclusively during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Okay, you went to Harvard. To what degree does that inform your music and your career?
I don't know that Harvard, if anything, I was an English major. And when I'm writing, I tend to be intimidated by the idea that Blake would never say anything that stupid. Or, you know, Shakespeare, oh no. I'm nowhere near that level. So that was a little bit intimidating, although it did expose me to a lot of really amazing writing. What was important, I think, was being in Cambridge, Massachusetts at that time, the early 60s, when there was such a vibrant folk scene going on, and being able to hang out at the Club 47 in Cambridge, which is a coffee house that was one block from my dorm room. And this was a place they hosted the local kids, as all the coffee houses did. But they also brought in the legends. And you could sit in this little 80-seat room and listen to Maybelle Carter or Flattin' Scruggs or Sleepy John Estes. They brought in a lot of the blues guys, and I adored the blues guys, partly because I was an English major. And just loved what these guys could do to syntax.
Okay. So what point did you pick up the guitar?
I picked up the guitar as a little kid. I was forced to take piano lessons for about 12 years, and I hated it. Nobody explained to me It's a little bit like studying English at Harvard. Nobody explained that these were great books because people loved to read them. It was your grim duty to study and analyze them. The piano was not fun. It was an exercise in manual dexterity. Nobody explained that this music was great music because people actually liked it. But I had an older cousin named Bo Beals. And Bo and B. Beals, I'm not making this up, used to come visit. They were my parents' best buddies. And Bo Beals was, in my eyes, a superstar. This guy could take a lit cigarette, flip it back into his mouth, dive in the swimming pool, and blow smoke bubbles from underwater. I mean, when you're 10, that's huge. And he played the ukulele. And Bo taught me how to play the ukulele and taught me a bunch of silly old songs, Abdullah Bulbul Amir and My Father's Whiskers. And that was a lot of fun. And that's where I just, you know, came to realize that music was fun. And then as I got older, the ukulele turned into a guitar because I thought it was more manly. And I got really swept up in the rock and roll scene in the late 50s. Heard my first Josh White recording when I was around 16. Changed my life. I'd never heard a guitar played like that. I'd never heard songs like that. And then I hit Cambridge, and there was all this music going on, all different flavors and stripes, and I just got sucked up into it.
So what was it like growing up in the 50s with the rock and roll era, Elvis, et cetera?
Well, it was absolutely magical. I mean, I remember Bill Haley and the Comets doing Rock Around the Clock and thinking, this is different. And then more and more and more kept coming. And it was a fabulous outpouring of talent. I mean, there were all these really talented people who were not like one another. Every single, you know, Elvis was not like Fats Domino, who was not like the Everly Brothers. They were each and every one was a totally different flavor, and it was very exciting. But the whole thing only lasted how many years? 4 years, maybe? And then it was gone. And what was on the radio next was really kind of boring in my mind, and I think in the minds of a lot of people, which is why the people in the Cambridge folk scene were so excited about discovering this music that nobody was trying to push down their throats on the radio. You'd have to go to the used record store and look for 78s and discover this stuff that was totally new. And it must have been, I mean, there's a certain irony in a bunch of Harvard kids sitting around singing about how tough it was in the coal mine or on the chain gang, but we felt that we made up in sincerity what we lacked in authenticity.
Okay, you heard that Josh White record. Did you pick out the notes yourself, or did you take lessons, or how'd you get up to speed?
I just listened to those records over and over and over and tried to figure out how he was doing what he did, and was moderately successful at that. I mean, he was playing by himself or with a bass player. So it was not, his guitar parts weren't obscured by a lot of instrumentation and other stuff. But I was pretty good at that. And then I also was fairly successful at figuring out what the blues guys were doing. One of the cool things about the Club 47, though, was when these blues guys played there, or whatever, the bluegrass guys or the Scottish balladeers, there was usually a party at Bob and Betsy Sagan's house after the show. And you could go to this party and ask these people, how do you do that thing you do? And they would tell you, they would show you. It was quite amazing.
Okay, so do you show up at Harvard with your guitar in its case?
Yes, I did. I did. And fairly quickly, I got there was a radio show on Harvard's FM station called Balladeers. And I somehow inherited that show. The guy that was hosting Balladeers was graduating or moving away or whatever. And somebody said, hey, do you want to take it over? And I said, well, okay. And it was a show where the host played a little bit, but you had to have guests come on. Every week there would be a different guest. And this meant that I had to start habituating the coffee houses, going to the Hootenannies to recruit guests to come on my show. The tradition was to have local kids as the guests. I also branched out and started getting people like Josh White or Odetta or Pete Seeger to come on. But mostly it was the local talent. And so I had to go to the Hootenannies and listen to people and decide who I wanted to invite. I discovered that you could get in for free if you had a guitar with you. I then discovered you could get in for free if you had a guitar case with you. So I would put a six-pack in the guitar case and head off to the Hootenanny. And I got caught one night at the Golden Vanity, a club in Boston. Hey, kid, get on stage. You got in for free. I had to borrow a guitar. I was terrified. But I got up and I did 20 minutes or something. And apparently it was good enough. I have no idea what I did. I was so scared. But about a week or two later, the owner calls me and said, whoever's playing tonight got sick, and could you come down and be a substitute folk singer? So I did that for a little while. And it's pretty much been downhill ever since, Bob.
Okay, let's go a little bit slower. The Balladeer show was on how often?
Once a week.
And how long was it?
It was 30 minutes.
Okay. Now, I certainly remember this folk era, the folk boom and the Hootenannies, but for those people, and, you know, we're on the wrong side of the curve, but explain what that scene was like.
Well, now they're called open mics, but basically it was, a bunch of kids would come and bring their guitars and there'd be an MC. And I can't remember actually if you had to audition to get into the Hoots. I don't think so. I think it was if you showed up with a guitar, you could get up and do two or three songs.
And how many of these places were there?
Oh, there were in the greater Boston area, there were probably a dozen.
And was there a palpable scene? Did you feel like you were part of something bigger? You say, well, you know, this is just what I'm into.
No, I think that, well, there was definitely, in my mind, there was a scene, because there was a lot of overlap. There were people who would, go and play this club and then that club. And in my mind, the Club 47 was the flagship of the Fleet. And they definitely there was a clique there. And I wanted very much to be part of that. And it took a while. But I finally got welcomed into the Club 47 scene. And
how long did that take?
Well, I'm trying to think. I was playing at a place called the Unicorn in Boston. The manager there felt that the best way to build an audience for an artist was to have them play the same day every week. And so I was playing every, Tuesday at the Unicorn. And sure enough, an audience started to accumulate after a while. That guy, Byron Leonardos, then went over. He was recruited to come manage the Club 47, and he basically brought me with him.
Right. You remember how much money you were making?
Oh, it was big bucks, Bob. I think, on a good night, you could clear $10.
But $10 was $100 then.
Well, I don't know about that. It was probably $73.
Okay, well, certainly,
It was enough to buy a six-pack and have some fun. But
who else was on the scene at your profile at that time?
Well, Joan Baez had kind of graduated from that scene. She'd up and gone. She would show up once in a while. But other people on the scene were Jim Queskin's Jug Band, Jeff and Maria Muldar. One of the striking things about the Cambridge scene, I think, Bob, was that it was basically an amateur scene in the good sense of the word. These are people playing because they loved the music, not because they had professional aspirations. There was, a psychopharmacologist banjo player who was very popular. But he didn't plan to be a professional banjo player. There was a typewriter repairman who was a mandolin player, high harmony singer, who was great. But he didn't, you know, plan to go on the road or anything. So there were a lot of really, really talented people who were not headed for professional life. The ones that did go pro are myself, Jim Queskin, of course, Jeff Muldaur, Maria Muldaur. It was a fairly small selection.
Okay, since you mentioned Jim Queskin, were you familiar with the Mel Lyman family?
I was, and it was a very puzzling thing. Mel was, for the listeners who don't know Mel, he was a harmonica player, pretty good one, but he also became a guru somehow. This guy attracted a family, not quite like the Manson family. They didn't do anything as bad as the Manson family, but it was, at least in my mind, it was a pretty strange cult that Mel assembled around him. Jim Queskin was and is still a part of that family. Mel died, but his gathering still is together in California, and I guess they have a pretty successful construction business that keeps them going. But Queskin's still out there playing. I went to see him. It was before COVID, so a year and a half ago maybe, and he's good. He's still as good as ever. He really engages the audience and draws them in, gets them going.
So how'd you make your first record?
I was playing at the Unicorn on a weekly basis. A guy named Dan Flickinger came in and said, "Do you want to make an album?" And I'd heard that a couple times before and nothing had come of it. So I said, "Yeah, sure." And he actually showed up dragging this tape recorder the size of an oven, dragged it down the flight of stairs into the basement and recorded two nights. I remember him saying that it was unethical to intercut, to splice, you know, take the first half of a song from night one and the second half from night two. Oh, no, that was morally indefensible. I later learned he didn't know how to splice tape. He didn't know how to edit. But it was put together, Tom Rush live at the Unicorn, on Dan Flickinger's little non-existent label, Lycornu, which was Latin for unicorn, or Greek, I think. And he distributed it out of the backseat of his Studebaker. But it was an odd thing because I had an album and nobody else did. And it somehow made me more legitimate. I was, you know, a more serious artist because I had an album. Never mind that it was, you know, on a made-up label. And, you know, I think we pressed 300 copies. I've seen them go for $300 on eBay now. But and then that lasted for about a minute. And then Vanguard and Prestige Records came to town and started signing up everybody except me. I couldn't get a real record label to sign me up. And finally, Paul Rothschild, working for Prestige, did sign me up. And I made my first album for a real label with Paul. By the time I graduated, I'd put out two albums, which probably explains why I didn't get better grades.
I would assume so. And to what degree did your profile at school change as a result of having these two albums?
I don't think, not by much. I mean, school was one thing. The folk scene was another thing. There was a little bit of overlap. But most of the people in my dorm had no idea what I did, except I made noise playing the guitar when they wished I wouldn't. So there wasn't too much overlap at that stage. Then, you know, when I became better known, I think the class of 63 now recognizes my name, but not back then.
Okay, so you graduate. What's your next step?
Well, actually, before I graduated, I took a year off. I was on the verge of flunking out. And in fact, I did flunk a course. And I decided I must take a break, or I'm just going to get kicked out. Okay,
the obvious question from this era is, what'd your parents say about that?
They were, you know, I think they were supportive. They thought forever that I'm going through a phase. My mom wanted to know till the dying day when I was going to get a real job. But I'd flunked one course. I don't remember having a talk with my parents. I'm sure I must have. But I said, okay, I want to take a year off. And Harvard at that point would let you, and then maybe they still do, would let you withdraw if you were in good standing. Let you withdraw anytime you want, come back anytime you want. I was not in good standing. I had to actually withdraw and reapply to get back in. So it was a risky proposition. But I felt pretty convinced that I was going to flunk out and be kicked out if I didn't do this. So I took a year off and I went to, I started traveling around and doing concerts, New York, got to Philadelphia, got to Florida a couple of times, and discovered that I really did love playing for people, still do, and that I could make just about enough money to live, nothing more, but I could... I could make enough money to pay the rent and buy some cheap groceries. Then I went back and finished up my three semesters. I quit in the middle of my junior year, so I had three semesters to go. Went back, actually did very well because I knew why I was there. I was there for a diploma. There was nothing romantic about it. I wanted to get that diploma and move on. So I did, and then continued living in Cambridge for a little while before I moved to New York City. New York is where the action was. It's where my record company was. I made one more album for Prestige with Paul Rothschild. It's a bit of a funny transition there. Paul moved on to Elektra Records, where he was their ace producer. And I wanted to go too. And Jack Holzman at Elektra wanted me on the label, but I had a contract with Prestige. So I went to Prestige and I said, can I get out of my contract? And said, no. And I bluffed. I said, okay, screw it. You know, I have a Harvard diploma. I don't need this music shit. I'm going to quit showbiz. But I tell you what, I'll make one more album for you if you'll let Paul Rothschild produce it. And they weren't happy with Paul at all. And they were convinced that Jack Holzman would never let Paul produce for another label. So they said, okay, kid. And so Paul and I went in the studio and we recorded my second Prestige album, which is all folky, just me and Fritz Richmond on washtub bass. The next week we went into a different studio and made my first Elektra album, which actually hit the market before the Prestige album came out because Prestige didn't know that this was going on in the background. And that's actually the album that Garth Brooks' dad played for him.
What did Prestige ultimately say?
What did they say?
When they found out that you'd pulled a fast one on them.
Well, they didn't have much to say about it. I mean, I was out of there, so they might have been yelling at me, but I couldn't hear them.
Okay. Now, you were famously the first to record so many legendary singer-songwriters, Jackson Brown, Joni Mitchell, James Taylor. How did you end up with their songs?
Well, it's a bit of a different story. For each one, I had made, oh, how many albums did I make for Elektra? I made the first one, and then I I think. In any case, I was running out of traditional folk stuff that I was interested in doing. My next to last album for Elektra was a bit schizophrenic. It was folk on one side and late 50s rock and roll on the other. And then I owed them, you know, I owed them more albums, and I didn't have any more songs that I was really excited about doing. I was playing a club in Detroit, Michigan called The Chessmate, one of my 2 week gigs. And this young slip of a girl named Joni Mitchell came in one night. And I gather she'd been playing there as part of a duo with her then husband, Chuck Mitchell, on a regular basis. But she just started writing songs and she wanted me to hear some of these new songs because I might record one or two. And she came in and did a little four-song guest set that just knocked me off my feet. I asked her if she had any more songs. She said, no, but give me a minute, or words to that effect. And then a few weeks later sent me a tape with six fabulous songs, one of which was The Circle Game, which I named the album after. She actually apologized on the tape. She said, I've just finished writing this. It's not much good. I'm so embarrassed, but here it is. And I ended up naming the album after it. Jackson Browne was being published. He was not really a performer at that point. He was a writer. And he was being published by Elektra, so I had access to his demo tapes. And that's how I met Jackson. James Taylor, it's a bit odd. I had a roommate in my Cambridge apartment. I had a roommate named Zach Wiesner, who was part of a band called The Flying Machine that James was in. It was James's band. And Zach kept saying, you got to hear this guy, James. And I kept saying, Zach, would you just pick up the living room, please? And I didn't meet James back then. And then Paul Rothschild said, you should get together with this guy. And I remember we sat on the floor in an empty room, no furniture, at the Elektra offices in New York. We sat on the floor with a reel-to-reel tape recorder. And James sang, you know, I don't know, half a dozen songs into the tape recorder for me. And he was, you know, I loved him. But the thing was that here were these songs that they weren't the other side of the moon from folk music. They were informed by that kind of sensibility, but they were much more literary. They had a lot more chords. They were just fabulous songs. And I've been accused of ushering in the singer-songwriter era with the Circle Game album, because it was the first, you know, time James, Jackson, and Joni were presented to a wider public. But I wasn't really looking to looking to introduce an era or discover anybody. I wanted to meet girls, Bob. That's why I was in the business.
How's that working for you?
Yeah.
No, literally, how is that working for you?
Well, it worked very well at the time.
Okay, and what kind of guy were you? Different girl in every town, or, you know, hometown honey, or what was it like?
Well, it was a different girl in every town kind of a scene for a while. I mean, I did have a girlfriend, Jill Lumpkin, who's on the one standing behind me on the Circle Game album. And that lasted for a few years. But, you know, I was basically the traveling musician.
So it was working for you.
Yeah, it was working for me.
Now, the cover of that album with Jill, that was shot by Linda McCartney, Linda Eastman at that point.
It was. I didn't know her. She was assigned by Elektra to take me out into Central Park and shoot some pictures. And got to know her a little bit later on. She'd keep in touch over the years. I remember at one point getting a note from her. I was playing somewhere on Long Island, and she sent me a note saying that she and Paul were in the neighborhood and might stop by, but it didn't happen.
As we wave goodbye to winter's chill, it's time to give our lawn a little love and embrace the freshness of spring. And guess what? The Home Depot's Spring Black Friday sale is here to make it all a breeze. Snag the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and say goodbye to tedious yard work. With a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power, your lawn will look spotless in a flash. And the best part? Thanks to the convenience of online shopping, you can effortlessly place your order via the app, cruise into the store for pickup, and find yourself chilling in your freshly spruced up yard in no time. Don't let this awesome deal blow away. Get your hands on the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for only $89. Yeah, just $89. Exclusively during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
So what was it like when the Beatles hit?
Well, I loved the Beatles along with everybody else. I mean, it was hard to resist that thing that they did. But I don't think it changed. I didn't want to become a Beatle or, you know, imitate them. I was doing my own thing. And the folk was morphing into folk rock at this point. And this is when I started getting a band, and we started getting louder and traveling more vigorously and more relentlessly. There was a 5-year period when I think I had 10 days off.
But did you feel like, holy shit, the British invasion is happening and it's killing my career, it's killing the whole scene I'm in?
I don't remember thinking that. No, I don't remember thinking that. I think my take was that there are a lot more people interested in music now than there were before. And I didn't have the Beatles were huge with the teeny boppers, and that wasn't my crowd anyway.
Okay, how'd you end up switching to Columbia?
After the Circle Game album, my contract with Elektra was up. And Jack Holzman was willing to renew the contract but not improve on it. And Columbia was willing to make a substantial, a much better offer. So I moved over there, and it was a bit of culture shock there, because Elektra really was a family. And Jack, you know, if you had a problem, you go to Jack and talk to him about it. And if he could, he'd fix it. At Columbia, you had to make an appointment to talk to anybody's secretary. Big, big building with everybody had to wear a tie. And very, very corporate. Entirely different scene there. But they did have, you know, they had a lot more marketing muscle than Elektra. And they, you know, they could make a lot of noise, which was good. You know, I never sold the tonnage for them that, you know, a lot of their acts were selling. But they made money on me. The way the deals were structured, basically, they paid for the record production, but then they also would bill against your royalty account. The production costs were billed against your royalties, and I was making, I don't know, 20 cents an LP, and they were making a couple of dollars an LP. So they were in the black very quickly. But working off a $100,000 production budget, plus then they would add, you know, promotional stuff to your production budget, to your royalty account, and paying it off at 20 cents a copy just wasn't happening. So they made money on me. I never got royalty checks. I would make some money off of the production budget when the album was made. But again, you know, the benefit was, if you didn't have a record deal, you didn't exist. They're, you know, what they did for me was they got my name out there. They got me on the radio. They got me written up in the magazines, newspapers, which sold tickets to the shows, which is always where I've made my living, is, you know, on stage. I've never found recordings to be really profitable. I've made some on my own label that have, you know, that yes, I've made money on them. But you know, on stage is where I've made my living forever.
So on those Columbia and Elektra records, are you still in the red, or are you ever getting royalty checks?
Well, I actually, the last album for Elektra, Ladies Love Outlaws, was put onto, no, wait a minute. Ladies Love Outlaws, there's a little bit of a kerfuffle there. If I may go off on a sidetrack, they had a deal with me where they had to renew my contract every year by a certain date. They failed to do that.
This is Elektra or Columbia?
This is Columbia. They failed to do that. And I said, okay, I'm out of here. And they said, no, you can't leave. If you leave and make an album for somebody else, we'll sue. So I got a lawyer, and the lawyer gave me, basically said, yeah, you got to do what they say. The lawyer then, within about a month, went to work for Columbia. So I think I might have been getting bad advice. But we made the Ladies Love Outlaws album to be the final album. And I was then they dropped me because it didn't sell as well as they'd hoped. So instead of being out on the street on my own volition, I was, you know, out on the street because Columbia had dropped me, which made getting a new deal a much more difficult thing. And I didn't, in fact, make another album for quite a while. Then they decades later, wanted to make a retrospective on me, and they wanted to record one new song, which John Leventhal produced. But we made that a separate deal. It was not the same, under the same contract. So I did make money on that one, on the retrospective. The Very Best of Tom Rush actually turned a profit for me. And then I didn't record for 35 years after Ladies Love Outlaws. Or actually, I shouldn't say that. I made a couple of live albums on my own label. We're profitable.
What was going on for 35 years in your mind, and what were you doing then?
Well, for a while I was courting the major labels unsuccessfully, trying to get a deal with a major. And because that didn't work out, I didn't go back in the studio. I was touring. I was making good money touring, figuring out how to connect with my audience. It was a strange thing. It was a strange period of time because the record industry had decided somewhere in the 70s that their audience, their core audience, was 18 to 23 years old. And the demographic that had built the record industry, the baby boom, was no longer 18 to 24 years old. They'd basically, the record industry let them walk out of the room. I remember being at a meeting at Columbia where they were talking about, how do we get the baby boom to buy our records? That's really important. We've got to get the baby boom buying our records. And some poor schmuck stood up and said, maybe if we made records they wanted to buy, they would buy them. And there was this awkward silence, and the guy sat back down, and the conversation continued about, well, how do we get these people to buy the records we're making? Anyway, I knew that my audience was still out there. They couldn't all have died at once. It would have been in the newspapers. So how do I connect with them? And so I started a mail order, snail mail campaign, build a mailing list. And I took out ads in New Yorker and sold albums through the mail. And it worked. You know, I wasn't selling tonnage by any means, but it was profitable.
Okay. Was it depressing?
No. Maybe it should have been. But it was a challenge, and I felt I was meeting the challenge, and it was, you know, what I was trying to do was working.
Okay, but at some point, you moved to New Hampshire, and you said, I'm going to become an agent.
Mm.
So you actually did pivot there at some point.
Well, I moved to New Hampshire. There was a point, early 70s, when a lot of my buddies were moving to the West Coast because that's where the action was now. And I decided I'm burned out. I want to go where the action isn't. And I went back to New Hampshire where I grew up, and I bought a farm. I had 600 acres with a house in the middle. And I basically rolled up the driveway and quit showbiz for about 6 months. And then I got audience deprivation syndrome kicked in, and I really wanted to play for people again. And so I started on a very small level. I got a secretary, and she called the venues that I used to play and booked me. And then I decided, well, there's some other artists, you know, that people I'm excited about, but they're just starting out in their careers. So as long as I'm booking, why don't I try to book them as well? And so Christine Lavin and Patty Larkin, Bill Morrissey, and a few others, I started booking them within my little booking agency, which was not profitable because we were selling, you know, getting maybe $250 a night for these people. And there's just no way to, you know, pay the phone bill and the heat and the electricity and the salaries and make that work. So I was funding the operation by going out on weekends and doing shows. And I remember there was an eye-opening moment. I did a show somewhere, and I broke a string in the last song of the evening. And I didn't have another gig for 3 weeks. And I got to that next gig, and I opened my guitar case, and the string was still broken. I said, nah, something's not right with this picture. And so I started slowing down, and at that point I had a house fire that pretty much destroyed the house and the studio and the office space we were using. So I, at that point, scaled way back, and I was still booking myself for a little while. I'm now working through Skyline Music, which has been great. But I got, you know, I got back on the road, and one thing led to another. And I finally ended up signing up with Appleseed Recordings and went back into a real studio with Jim Rooney, my old buddy, producing down in Nashville. And that was, on the one hand, it was kind of disorienting because I had not been in a digital studio. Everything was analog in my head. And I just couldn't adjust my brain to the idea that I would come out of the vocal booth and say, I think I sang a little bit flat on that. And the engineer would interrupt me and say, I fixed it. I said, I came in a little bit late. I fixed it. Why am I here? Why don't I just sing one note, every note once and go home? But it really is, it's a major, major step forward. It makes recording a lot more fun, a lot less tedious. And then I made my second album of voices, my most recent one, with Jim Rooney in Nashville. And that's the first album I ever wrote all the songs on. I'd always done mainly other people's songs, a couple of my own. And I didn't set out to write an entire album, but I just, when I sat down and looked at the song list, I said, hey, I wrote all of these. And I think it's my best album. And at this point, I've got enough new songs for another new album.
Okay, let's go back. At what point, like if Circle Game ironically has legendary songs by others that you first recorded, but also a couple of your own legendary compositions. So at what point did you start to write and how did you balance whether you wanted to use other people's songs or your own?
Well, I'll back up to that first Live at the Unicorn album. There's a song on there called Julie's Blues, and I'm uncertain as to whether I should say that I wrote it or assembled it. It's almost entirely compiled of floating verses, which is the folklore term for verses that appear in a lot of different songs. So there are a lot of lines in there that I lifted from this blues or that blues, and I assembled the song. I don't feel I really wrote it. But technically, it's, you know, the copyright's in my name. So I wrote that. The second one was On the Road Again, which I just actually served up yesterday for Rockport Sundays because I'm on the road again going to Alexandria to play the Birchmere. And that was basically, that song is from what I call the Rand McNally School of Songwriting. You know, talking about a trip to Florida. And then the third song I ever wrote was No Regrets, which came about because my girlfriend, Jill Lumpkin, who was on the cover of the Circle Game album, had come to Boston. She wasn't my girlfriend at that point. She came to Boston and spent the weekend with me. And I had never at that point spent an entire weekend with anybody before. 3 days and three nights in a row. And I took her back to Logan Airport on Monday morning to put her on the plane. And it felt strange walking away alone. And I went back to my apartment and started working on No Regrets, which is about the end of a long relationship where it feels strange walking away alone, feels strange lying awake alone, feels strange living my life alone. And then we actually did have a long relationship and we broke up and that song came true. But that was the third song I ever wrote. And it's the one that's been covered by a lot of people. Johnny Cash and Waylon Jennings. And
where's Julie Lumpkin today?
Jill Lumpkin. Jill Lumpkin. I've been out of touch with her for quite a while, but my understanding is she's in India. While we were together, I sent her to the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York. I paid her tuition to go there, and she got into the clothing trade and ended up spending a lot of time in India. My understanding is that she moved there. She adopted a young orphan kid, and that young orphan kid is now a very wealthy man who bought her a house. and is basically taking care of her, which I think is a fabulous story.
Do you know how the kid became so wealthy?
I do not.
But she never got married. You ruined her for that.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't think she ever got married. I'm pretty sure she didn't.
Okay, and you've been married twice.
I have been. I'm currently married, yes.
But your first marriage, how did you finally decide to tie the knot and what killed that?
Well, it was being on the road so much. I was a rotten husband, basically, being on the road so much. And, I have two boys from that marriage, and I feel badly that I was also not a very good dad for them. I'm hopefully a better dad now than I was back then, but I was just gone a lot. And, my wife, Beverly, got sick of it and moved out, and we got divorced.
And did she ever get remarried?
She did not.
Okay. And what's your relationship with those sons today?
It's good. One of them's in Scotland. One of them's in Arizona. But we're in touch on a regular basis.
And you have a younger daughter, too.
I have a daughter who's just 21, a senior, halfway through her senior year in college. And we have a very good relationship.
But, when one goes to see you live, there's tons of humor. You say, well, I decided to have my own grandkids, et cetera. So to what degree is humor important in your life and in your show?
I think it's essential. It's essential in life. I mean, there's just, especially now, there's so much grim stuff going on. I would rather laugh than cry, so I will try to figure out where the funny side of things is and go there. And I think for the shows, I learned very early on, Bob, that if the audience likes you, they are much more apt to like the song you're about to do. So I started telling, stories about the songs or stories that weren't about the songs, to try to, lighten the mood and draw the crowd in. And it worked to the point where I now get requests for the stories. Tell the one about the guy from New Hampshire. It blows my mind. But I actually put out an album called Trolling for Owls that is a compilation of silly stories and funny songs. Somebody said, you should really compile those all into an album, and I did, and people seem to like it a lot. I have to warn people, do not drive while listening to this album, because I've had many people say, I almost went off the road.
And are the stories the same every night?
They evolve. I remember once you questioned the veracity of some of my songs, some of my stories. And I think my reply was that my stories are not just true. They are in many cases better than true, having been polished, not unlike gemstones in the tumbler of time.
Now, you mentioned you have an agent you're very happy with. What is your view on managers?
I have had bad luck with managers. And so I currently do not have a manager. I am my own manager, which is a lot like trying to be your own dentist. It's probably not the smartest thing to do, but I've had bad luck with managers. Managers giving me bad advice and getting me to do things that didn't work out and so forth and so on. It's not like, I'd be a rock star today if it wasn't for this crummy manager. But I seem to do okay.
And are there certain songs you absolutely have to play in every show?
I would say no, although there's a list of songs from which I should do some. I mean, my crowd comes. I've got a problem in that I've got a bunch of new songs that that I think are really good. And in fact, the audience thinks they're really good. But the fact is they came to hear the songs they know. And so I've got to scratch that itch for them. I've got to do something from, I've got to do either Urge for Going or Circle Game or No Regrets or These Days or Driving Wheel or Who Do You Love or, you know, there's a certain number of songs that I've got to do five or six of them during the course of the evening. But the good news is, having been doing this for 58 years, there's quite a long list that I have to choose from.
Every time I've seen you, you've done the Panama Limited. Is there shows you don't do it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Okay, and so now 58 years in, you don't have the choice. But if you could do it all over, would you be a professional musician, or would you have done something else?
I think, you know, yeah. I can't imagine having more fun doing anything else. My career path was not really set, having graduated from Harvard with an English Lit degree. There's no straightforward career path there except to be an English teacher. And I certainly didn't want to do that. So I don't know what else I would have done. I went to see David Geffen at one point when I was shopping for a record deal. And I knew David from earlier on in his career and in my career. And I pitched him the idea of signing me up to Asylum. And he said, I thought you wanted a producer's job, an A&R job. And I guess, having picked songs from Joni Jackson and James, that might have been a reasonable notion that, okay, this guy's got good ears. But I really had no interest in doing that. You know, I love getting in front of an audience.
And with the time you have left, anything you want or need to accomplish?
Well, I'd like to get Rockport Sundays up closer to that 7.5 billion subscribers mark. I've got three books in the works, maybe four, depending on how you count them. I definitely want to make another album with Jim Rooney in Nashville, record some of these new songs that haven't seen the light of day yet. I'd also like to, the Club 47, was very important to me. And at one point, I now own the name Club 47, and I've done shows under that banner. And the theme of those shows is I get a couple of well-known artists and a couple of newcomers together, and I browbeat everybody into playing with one another. You can't just go out there and do your regular thing. You've got to sing harmonies with this kid, or you've got to play, guitar behind this kid, or this kid has to sing harmonies with you. And the audiences love it because they get to hear, the newcomers are monstrously talented. They're just unknown. And so the audience goes home thinking, wow, I just heard something really special. So I would love to do some Club 47 shows in the vein of Rockport Sundays. I would love to get different artists that are buddies of mine, maybe some that aren't. I would love to call, I'd love to call Garth Brooks and say, is there a kid that you're really excited about? Would you like to come do some songs with me where, you do a song, I do a song, we do a song together, the kid does a song, and we'll try to get this kid noticed. I mean, this is partly why, I've enjoyed working with Matt Nicoah so much, is I do think I have helped get his name out there. I've helped him move along. His audience, he's got a different audience than I do, but my audience loves him to bits, and they are now part of his audience.
Just going back to the books for a second, because I know on the Patreon, in addition to the music, you also reveal or distribute other information that might be part of the book. So is there one main book, like an autobiography, that you're working on?
The books, well, part of what I'm doling out to the $25 a month crowd is pages from the book of lyrics that I'm writing. It's the lyrics to my songs with maybe a page or two of backstory about the song and what I was doing at this point in my life. It's becoming a little bit of an autobiography. But then the main autobiography is kind of stalled out. The other book that, and then there's a novel that I'm only writing for my own entertainment. I write it because I want to find out what happens next. I don't think it'll ever happen, see the light of day probably. But the other book that I'm having fun with is called Roadmap, working title Roadmap. And subtitle is Why You Probably Don't Want to Be a Touring Musician. And it's a story, it's just stuff about, you know, how to do a sound check, how to conduct an interview, how to keep mentioning Rockport Sundays, even though you're not being asked about it. What does a manager do as opposed to an agent? Band dynamics, you know, how to conduct a rehearsal, how to read an audience, how to do a sound check. And I've got about, I don't know, about 350 pages so far.
Now, how many more are going to be necessary before you whittle it down?
They're very disorganized now. So basically, part of what's good about the Patreon model is that it forces me to work on these things because I've got to, you know, next Sunday I've got to put something out. So I've got to finish up this thing that's only half finished. But that book, you know, I've just written a page or two or a paragraph or 10 pages every time something occurs to me. I'm sure I've covered the same turf twice, three times in some cases. And then there's going to be gaps where I didn't write something that should have been written. So basically I need to organize that and get it shaped up and presentable.
And, you know, you do these things Rockport Sunday, and you have these live performances. So they all done at once and then dribbled out, or do you get together once a week?
No, it's complex enough to get everybody in the same rooms that we record a bunch at once and then serve them up.
Okay, well, I'll look forward to next Sunday. Thanks for taking the time here, Tom. I know you got to get back to work for the deadline, so thanks for doing this.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Bob. Pleasure.
Till next time. This is Bob Lefsetz.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower. Now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.